You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. This is NPR News. I'm Chris Farrell, in today for Carrie Miller. Social Security, signed into law in 1935 by President Franklin Roosevelt, is probably the most important earned benefit for the typical worker in household. Almost all workers contribute into Social Security. The Social Security Administration will pay out so $1.1 trillion in benefits to 69 million recipients of Social Security retirement, disability, and supplemental security income. This morning, we'll focus on Social Security as retirement benefit. Now, the landmark legislation has evolved into the most successful social policy program in modern U.S. history. Yet every time I get into a conversation with neighbors and colleagues about retirement, it seems someone will always say, with a sigh and a shrug, Social Security won't be there when I retire. Yes, Social Security faces a well-known financial shortfall. The latest projections are that the system will confront a funding shortfall in 2034 if Washington does nothing and allows that grim moment to pass. So, let's talk Social Security, its prospects, its problems, and its promise. First, let me give out the number, because we want to hear from you. Do you have a question about Social Security? Wondering when you should claim your benefit? Give us a call, 651-227-6000, toll-free, 800-242-2828. Online, it's talk@nprnews.org. Now, my two guests are well-versed in Social Security and retirement security, and I'm thrilled they can join us this morning. Mark Miller is a journalist and author who writes on trends in retirement and aging. He's a columnist for Reuters, Morningstar, and Wealth Management. He also contributes to New York Times, PBS Next Avenue, and the AARP magazine. His latest book is Jolt, Stories of Trauma in Transformation. Mark joins us from Chicago. Welcome.
Chris, good morning. Thanks for inviting me.
Teresa Ghilarducci is a labor economist and expert in retirement security. She is professor of economics at the New School for Social Research and director of the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis and the Retirement Equity Lab. Her most recent book is Rescuing Retirement. It was co-authored with Tony James, executive vice chairman of the Blackstone Group. Teresa joins us from Santa Cruz, California. Is that right?
That's right. I'm visiting my mother. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. So I want to start out with this one question that, as I said, always comes up when the topic of Social Security arises. And I'm going to ask both of you the same question. I'm going to start with you, Teresa. Is Social Security bankrupt?
No. No.
Okay.
No, not at all.
Mark?
No.
Okay, now we'll elaborate a little bit more on this. But my other quick question, though. I got another quick question for both. Will Social Security be there when workers who are now in their 20s reach their 60s? Teresa?
I have no doubt. No doubt at all, based on history and based on what I know about politics and based on what I know about the program.
All right. Mark?
Yes, I think it will be there. The second question I would append to that is, will the benefits be as robust as they are today? How will the program change over time? Social Security, I think, faces some questions and issues, but will it be there? Absolutely. I think the public support for Social Security and Medicare, for that matter, is very, very strong. So I think the politics dictates that these programs continue. There's no more important program for the retirement security of Americans than Social Security, full stop. It is just by an exponential factor more important than anything else we could compare it to that we have in our economy right now.
So, Teresa, off of that, how important is the Social Security benefit to the typical worker?
I would like to say to the typical economy and town and region. So for a typical worker, they are going to depend upon Social Security for over half of their income. And if we just take out the people in the richest zip codes in our country. You know, just look at the bottom 80% of all workers and ask the question, how important will Social Security be for them when they retire? Everybody, you know, but the richest folks. Most everybody is going to depend upon a majority of their retirement income from Social Security. So as Mark said, that has a political base, you know, for the program when over half of Americans are at the current time about ready to collect Social Security or collecting Social Security. But many communities would be devastated without that income coming into their communities. So from a micro perspective, from the household perspective, it is what sustains them. And also from a macro perspective, it is what sustains many communities.
Okay, so
could I add to that,
please,
Chris, briefly, that I think another aspect of the political support for Social Security is the all-in participatory nature of the program. We all pay into it. I think most workers are aware that they're contributing via the payroll tax. And so there's a sense of ownership there. And I think, you know, people, you know, feel that sense that this is something that they're, that it's an earned benefit and that they need to be focused on.
Okay. So then, Mark, how do you think about the shortfall? I mean, describe to us the shortfall, and then how do you think about it? Because it is nerve-wracking that come 2034, I think is the latest year, that this shortfall is going to kick in.
So this is where your initial question, Social Security, is it bankrupt, ties back. And the political rhetoric when people say Social Security is bankrupt is a false statement that ties back to the notion that Social Security's savings account, if you will, the trust funds where the surplus funds of Social Security are held, that those surplus funds are scheduled to be exhausted roughly 2034. At that point, Social Security will have enough money coming in the door from current payroll taxes to fund roughly three quarters of benefits. So absent anything being done to affect that, you're looking at a 25% across the board benefit cut around 2034, which is a nightmare scenario that I've been covering retirement now for more than a decade. I've always been working under the assumption that at some point Congress would come around and resolve this problem. There are many ways to address it. It's not really, from a math standpoint, a difficult problem. It is politically a tricky issue as to, and we can get into the detail of what one needs to do to avoid that sort of benefit cliff, if I could put it that way, in 2034.
And so, Teresa, when you're looking at this funding shortfall, how big of an issue is this when we look at the economy as a whole? I mean, it's always treated as like there's this giant shortfall. And as Mark said, okay, they continue to do the benefits, 75%. But as a part of this economy, it doesn't seem like this is outside the realm of political compromise. We can do this. We can shore this up.
Yeah, I want to underscore what Mark said and talk about the politics. First of all, it's a remarkable program because it is so trusted. You could be a left-wing economist or right-wing economist. You could be in the Trump administration or the Obama administration, and everybody agrees on the numbers. So when the public debates Social Security, we're not debating about the numbers. And that's actually quite remarkable and a testament to how well-trusted the civil servants who run the Social Security system are. So the baseline numbers are agreed upon both sides. So now you asked me, what is the magnitude of the issue if we wanted to fix it today? And unlike many other problems we have, the magnitude is not that large. If everybody paid 2% more Social Security tax, we don't, and that's just not raising the earnings cap. We can talk about that later. It's not changing the rules in any way. We just have every wage earner pay 2% little and some more, meaning the employer picks up half of that and the employee picks up half of that, it probably would not affect the economy at all in terms of consumer spending and in terms of even lifestyle. At the very bottom of the income distribution, the wage distribution, the minimum wage worker may feel a 1% change, but that increase, but that would be made up by the earned income tax credit. So just from an economic point of view, if today we had the political will to put the Social Security system on track to pay benefits for the next 75 years, full benefits 75 years, it would have virtually no impact on the economy.
Okay, let me give
could I add to this?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I wanted to comment on the idea that Social Security is trusted, and I very much agree with what Teresa is saying about the numbers, and the actuaries come out with the numbers, and all the economists on all sides nod their heads. I very much agree with that. But I think the unfortunate thing is that Social Security is under political attack to undermine the trust that exists in the program. And it's false rhetoric. And, you know, we hear these statements that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme, or that Social Security's trust fund is nothing but a bunch of IOUs. We hear politicians saying that Social Security is a driver of the federal deficit. Demonstrably right. False statement. That Social Security is unaffordable because of our aging population. False. You started the program. Will it be there for young people? It's bankrupt. I could go on and on. I mean, the list of myths is long. And so, you know, Social Security is under attack politically, and it's under attack from a financial standpoint. So I very much agree that with what Teresa was saying, that the numbers, I think, are agreed on. But the problem I see is how we debate and discuss those numbers.
All right, let me get out the number again, which is, do you have a question about Social Security, about how it works, when you should claim your benefit? Questions about what kind of solution would improve Social Security's finances. Give us a call, 651-227-6000, toll-free, 800-242-2828, and online, it's talk@nprnews.org. Now, I want to go to the phone lines, and we have Wayne from Eagan. Wayne?
Yes.
So what's your question?
I just had a comment that maybe we could stretch out the date past 2034 by lowering the annual cost of living adjustment.
Okay.
Knock off 0.5% or 1%.
So is this a solution you favor, or you think that at least this would help out? Well, okay. So, Teresa, why don't you take this? Because, you know, changing the cost of living adjustment, that comes up a lot.
Yeah.
And explain what the cost of living adjustment is, first of all.
Yes, and Mark, jump in if you want. So we look at the program shortfall, and we look at ways that we can solve it. We can cut benefits, or we can raise revenue. The cost of living adjustment is in the category of cutting benefits. The cost of living adjustment is an increase in the benefits of all Social Security recipients based on the inflation of the last year. So it keeps up the purchasing power of a recipient benefits so that it doesn't erode over time because of inflation. If we let the Social Security benefit erode because of inflation, and people have been on the Social Security, you know, for 20 years throughout their retirement life, we would have the very oldest people really suffering because their Social Security check has shriveled compared to the cost of living. So if we cut the Social Security COLA benefit, did not adjust it for inflation, it would save about 20% of the shortfall. So we wouldn't actually bring the Social Security system completely into benefit, but we would get partly way, but it would be totally on cutting benefits for the very oldest. And it would affect older, lower-income women by far the most. And we predict it would put a substantial number of people over the age of 80 below the poverty line. So I don't support it as a way to bring solvency to the system.
Okay, and then quickly
agree there. And, you know, it's remarkable that it's one of the few Social Security reforms, as Teresa's pointing out, I just want to underscore this, that would phase in quickly and immediately for all beneficiaries. Usually Social Security reforms that involve benefit cuts are phased in very slowly over time, with lots of time for people to prepare, for example, the gradual increase in the retirement age that we're in the middle of now, that was passed in 1983. We're not even done with it yet. So, you know, it's a relatively small fix in terms of the overall shortfall, and it would have immediate impact. And the the COLA, the cost of living adjustment, or COLA as it exists today, you know, doesn't really keep up with some of the types of inflation that seniors tend to face, for example, medical inflation.
Okay. So, Mark, let me quickly on raising the age. So this is a common proposal that's out there. People are living longer, and we should raise the age when you can claim Social Security.
Right. So, yes, this is another one. We're all living longer, therefore we should raise the Social Security age. Well, raising it, depending on how you do it, might eliminate as much as 25% of the shortfall. The problem with raising the retirement age is the pain is not shared evenly. A very interesting new paper done by our economist Richard Johnson at the Urban Institute, and anybody who really wants to dig in the detail of this issue, I highly recommend Googling it, Richard Johnson at Urban Institute. He calculates that increasing the retirement ages would have a very severe economic impact on about 25% of beneficiaries for a variety of reasons that include everything from inability to work longer is probably the most important factor. So, you know, it's one thing to, you know, sit in a nice comfy office at a think tank in Washington and say, we should all work longer, you know, in your nice air conditioned office. It's different when you're, you know, a 56-year-old factory floor worker. So, and Teresa is an expert in this area. I shouldn't go too much on it because she can talk about it much more eloquently than I can. But that's one of the big issues is the ability to stay employed. And then when you raise retirement ages, it's effectively a benefit cut. A lot of times this is not understood. It sounds so reasonable to say, oh, sure, we're all living longer, therefore lift the age. Well, the problem with that is that when you raise the age of full retirement benefit, the age at which you're entitled to 100% of your benefit, when you increase that age, it essentially is raising the bar of what it takes to get to your full benefit. So it's often not understood as a retirement benefit, but a cut, excuse me. But right. That's exactly what it is.
All right, let's go to Will, and you're in Mendota Heights, right, Will?
Correct. Thank you.
So question or comment?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you guys about the differing opinions that we all get on take Social Security as early as you can because the money that you'll get between then and when the benefit maximizes is greater than that maximized amount that you get if you postpone it and how to think about that. I mean, I know a lot of it depends on how long someone may live, but how should we as benefit recipients approach that question?
Well, I am so glad you asked this question because this is really important. Teresa, you want to take this?
Oh, it's one of my favorite questions. Delaying Social Security collection is about the best deal on the planet. It's because of Congress gave people who delayed a month, a year, all the way up to age 70, a huge rate of return bonus for waiting. You can earn on average 6.3% on your money by just waiting to collect Social Security. If you wait between 67 and 70, you get 8% return on your money. And there's no guaranteed rate of return like that on Earth. So it's one of the best deals around. So if somebody can wait by either working a little bit longer or drawing down on their 401k or IRA benefits faster than you normally would to bridge from when you stop working to retirement. It's one of the best ways you can use your money.
And Mark, I imagine you get a lot of questions about this sort of break-even rate calculation that
yes.
comes out a lot. Elaborate on
yes.
this.
Yes, a lot of people worry about the idea that by delaying they might die early and therefore will not recoup the dollars that they hope to get by delaying. And it's an understandable worry. I tend to think about Social Security as a lifetime guaranteed income source. To me, this is the most important part of it. I mean, none of us know how long we'll live. So the idea of maximizing monthly or annual income to me is paramount. And it's, as we were discussing a minute ago, an inflation-protected source of income, which is also I believe, unique. I mean, there may be some annuity. There are annuities you could purchase in the commercial market that come with inflation protection, but there's
they're
a
expensive.
Cost to that.
They're very expensive to buy, yeah.
But even the traditional defined benefit pension does not come with a cost of living adjustment. And the delay, this issue of break even and, you know, will I make it to my break even point, is something to think about differently if you're single versus married. Because for married couples, there's a very high likelihood that one spouse will live way past the break even point, typically the woman, because women outlive men. And so what you're aiming towards is this guaranteed lifetime income stream at an advanced age, perhaps for a widow, you know, who has reached the point where savings are exhausted. I mean, for most households have not saved a ton for retirement anyway. Even those that have, you know, it's likely that those funds get exhausted at the point of an advanced age. And so there's a huge value in that guaranteed lifetime income stream because, you know, you talk about the uncertainty of a break-even point. What's really uncertain is how long you can make stretch savings out over an uncertain number of years of retirement.
So
many of us really want to eliminate that break-even analysis from the Social Security website and from the vocabulary of financial planners, because it's not the right calculation.
Yeah,
and the SSA has been instructed by Congress to stop doing it, to stop even providing that analysis.
That's right, Mark. Yeah, it's actually a false analysis.
So let's go to Jim in Stillwater. Jim?
Hey, how are you guys today?
Good. What is your question, comment?
So we all know that Congress doesn't participate in the Social Security system. Number one, is that true for all federal employees? And the larger question, you know, how do we get them to participate in the Social Security system so they have the same incentive to manage it and do the correct things as opposed to just kicking the can down the road?
All right. Teresa?
Most federal employees are now participating in Social Security. Mark, you actually might have the date.
I think it deals with the phase in of the Thrift Savings Program, if I recall, and the phase out of the traditional freezing, I should say.
And I think it's completely phased in now, isn't it?
Yes.
It's awfully close if it's not. If you're just joining us, I'm Chris Farrell, in today for Carrie Miller. Our topic is Social Security. My guests are journalist and author Mark Miller, who writes on retirement and aging for several news outlets, including Reuters, The New York Times, and AARP Magazine. Teresa Gallarducci is a professor of economics at the New School for Social Research. So what do you want to know about Social Security? Give us a call, 651-227-6000, toll-free, 800-242-2828. Online, it's talk@nprnews.org. And I want to go right back to the phone lines, and we're going to go to Bob, who is in Ramsey. Bob?
Thank you for taking my call, Chris.
Sure.
I have a close friend in his mid-60s, so he's approaching retirement. He was married for 40 years. His spouse never worked during those years, and they were just recently divorced. And he told me that his spouse will receive the exact same Social Security benefit that he qualifies for based on his income. And that seems, just on the financial end of it, seems odd to me that being that for 40 years only one person paid in, now two will receive a full benefit. So my question is, first of all, is that correct? Second is, how can we financially afford it if it is? And third, what prevents fraud in that case from someone, you know, faking a divorce and continuing to live together to get two full benefits?
All right, Mark, do you want to take this?
Well, that's right. It surprises a lot of people to know that divorced spouses can qualify for a benefit as though they were still married. I don't know exactly. I'm trying to recall the rules on how you go about
it's 10 years.
That. It may be
you at least been married 10 years, and then you can claim the full benefit, correct?
Yeah, and that, I think, is part of the notion of avoiding any kind of fraud creeping in. I believe that the rules are that you just qualify for the same spousal benefit that you would. In other words, not 100% of the benefit unless you were a survivor. Now, so as a survivor,
Yeah, that's right.
Even as a divorced spouse, you would then qualify for 100% of the deceased spouse's benefit. However, otherwise, you would qualify for under the normal spousal rules, which typically would be half of the divorced spouse's benefit.
Okay. Teresa, that's right?
Yeah, no, I think your friend is wrong. The divorced spouse will only get the spousal benefit, which is half of his worker benefit. So your friend just misunderstood. If he dies, she'll get the full survivor benefit as if she were still married. And this really helps protect the traditional family who had that situation, never worked, and the right. male breadwinner worked. But that situation is really disappearing. And it was just part of the total insurance benefit. And the fact that that kind of benefit is really rare, is going to become more rare, really attests to how flexible the Social Security system is to sort of changing family norms and societal norms.
Okay, let's go to John in Rochester. And this is Rochester, New York, not Rochester, Minnesota. Is that right, John?
Yes, it is. Thank you. I'm a financial planner, and it's interesting that over the last 30 years, Social Security benefits have been decreased through different changes to the program. But I think you're going to see a call to increase Social Security benefits. And for the simple fact that, for instance, the people between 50 and 65 who are beginning to retire are way undersaved. They don't have enough. They're middle-class people that don't have enough to retire. And younger people who are facing diminished wages and working for companies that don't have pension plans or even municipal plans, public plans, are being cut back. I think you're going to have to see an increase in Social Security benefits to keep people out of poverty.
All right. So, John, you've raised a really important question. I want both Teresa and Mark to address this. I'll start off with you, Teresa.
Probably Mark agrees. I am really shocked that over the last 3 years, the most important and significant discussion about Social Security is not how to cut the program, but to how to expand it. And our caller is correct. We are seeing a generation of people approaching retirement that are going to be in worse shape than their parents or grandparents in terms of being able to replace their income to just maintain their standard of living. Nobody really expects to get richer as they retire or have more income when they retire. But the expectation that you work your entire life and you can maintain that standard of living, especially if you're middle class, lower middle class, into retirement, is certainly an expectation. And we're seeing that that's not true because the 401k, the do-it-yourself system that replaced the traditional pension system over the past 40 years really has failed most workers. So people are coming into this system almost more reliant on Social Security for lifetime income than they ever had before when the Social Security system began. And we are now seeing ways to expand revenue into the system by taxing, capital gains, taxing income that comes from stocks and bonds and other kinds of wealth, and actually increasing the earnings cap. So I suspect most of the debate about Social Security will be how to expand benefits.
Okay. Mark, what do you want
to
add?
Yes, well, I agree with that background very much, especially the decline of the traditional pension in the private sector and the other factors that have been mentioned with the problems with the private individual account saving system, 401k and the like. And I think there are many ways to fund an expansion. Teresa mentioned several. One that I find intriguing would be to allow the Social Security Trust Fund to invest a small portion of its reserves in equities. Right now, Social Security is restricted by law to invest only in special issue treasury notes, which have, of course, a lower rate of return.
So like a giant
and even
index
a small
fund.
Yeah, even a small investment in equities could, change the math on and create the opportunity to expand. Now, on the politics, I covered this in a piece I did in last Sunday's New York Times business section looking at the outlook for retirement policy next year. With the Democrats taking control of the House next year, a couple of interesting things happen. Well, there is the leading bill to expand Social Security is sponsored by John Larson, who's a Democratic member of the House from Connecticut. And there are 170 co-sponsors of that bill, including the incoming chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, Richard Neal of Massachusetts. And Larson is expected to become the head of the Ways and Means Social Security Subcommittee. So now the chief proponent of Social Security expansion is going to be running a very important committee in the House. What does it mean? I think there's a pretty good chance next year that Larson's bill gets a hearing. You know, it could even get out onto the floor for a vote. Could the House approve legislation for expanding Social Security? I think it could. I think it's going to depend very much on the overall philosophic approach of the leadership in the House, you know, next year, not just on Social Security, but do they want to lay down a marker on where Democrats would take the country if Democrats had control of the Senate and the White House again. And the Larson's bill, you know, it has several different expansion components to it. One is a 2% across the board increase in benefits. It would install a more generous cost of living increase, not a stingier one. Would include a higher minimum benefit for low income workers, and it would also increase the amount that is exempted from taxation. You know, Social Security benefits are taxed. For high earners pay some income taxes on their benefits. So it raise that ceiling so fewer workers are taxed. And then it includes a variety of ways to pay for the expansion that includes some of those that we've already discussed.
All right, let's go to Tammy in River Falls. Tammy?
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
My question has to do with the gap between if I were to I'm going to be 59 and a half soon, and I'm not going to be able to retire right then, but I'm looking forward to paying off my mortgage and in the next couple of years and maybe dialing back on how much I work. But I understand if I delay taking Social Security, you know, the increased benefit from that, obviously, you just spoke about recently. My question is, I understand that Social Security averages out your last 3 years of income, and if I were to dial back my the number of hours, therefore my income goes down. How would that be a big factor in how much I would be able to receive from Social Security? I'll take my answer off the call.
Teresa?
Oh, yeah. So make sure, that's a great question, make sure that your 35 years of work is at a high income, because Social Security bases your benefits on your 35 years of your top pay. So if you scale back too early in your career, the Social Security Administration is going to look at you as a lower income worker, and then you'll get lower benefits because the more you make, the higher your Social Security benefits. Whether or not it's a big impact really depends upon your particular situation, but it's a great question.
So
yeah, I mean, I doubt that 3 years of lower earning at the end would have a big impact, yeah, because it is the 35 highest earning years that are used to compute the benefit.
Yeah.
Let's go to Pam in Edina. Pam, what's your comment?
Hi. Well, I have a couple comments. First of all, the cost of living adjustment is kind of a fallacy. I have looked at my what I've received from the government over the last several years, and it kind of bounces around. It started at $23,000 a year, and then it dropped down to around $21,000. But they don't report the total amount every year. They tell you, well, then the next time you'll get $1,900 or $1,100 a month, and then the next time they say, okay, you're going to get $1,900 a month, and then the next time you'll get $1,800 a month, and then the next time you'll get $22,000 a year. So it's kind of crazy that
way. All right, so let's take this. Teresa?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think what might be happening is that the Social Security Administration will increase
they never decrease it because of inflation. Like if inflation went down, they wouldn't cut your right. cut your benefit.
You just zero it out, right? Just there's just no increase.
Right, right. So that's actually you get a downside protection in that way. But what also changes is your Medicare premium. So the net Social Security benefit might fluctuate like that, not just always go up. So that's what might the caller might be referring to. So, and it's also true, you don't know how much your income is going to go up by the next year in terms of just dollar amounts, but the system is set that your purchasing power stays the same. So your real income stays the same, but not your, but not the nominal amount.
Right. So, so a dollar in 2018 will be worth a dollar in 2019.
And 2035.
35, exactly.
Yeah.
Let's go to Ruthie in Wadena. Did I say that right, Ruthie?
Yeah, yes, you did. Thank you.
Okay.
My question is for my daughter. She is now 51 years old, and she out of high school, she went to was in the Air Force for 4 years, and then started her college career. And midway in her college career, her only sibling, my son, was diagnosed with incurable cancer, and she quit college and came home to help me take care of him.
And, I'm sorry.
As is often the case, thank you. As is often the case, she didn't get back to college right away. She had to save money, and she became an older than average student, and she got her degree, and she has a very good job as an industrial engineer with a good Minnesota company that's good to its employees. But she's now 51 years old and doesn't have, I just want to know if they have some advice for what she should be doing besides just saving money.
Okay.
She's very good at that.
You've got two good people that can at least might have a thought or two to that she could think about. We'll start with you, Mark.
So, I'm sorry, at what age did she actually begin her working career?
6 years ago. So she was 45, maybe 45.
So relatively recent, right?
43, 45 in there.
So on the Social Security front, so to qualify for the good, one bit of good news is to qualify for Social Security, you need 10 years of work. So she undoubtedly will have that. And they take, again, as we were saying a minute ago, your 35 highest years of work to calculate your benefit. Sounds like she might have some 0 years in that 35, which will bring her benefit down somewhat. But if she's earning at a high level now, you know, that should come out in the wash, I would think. And then beyond that, I think the advice is to save as much as you possibly can in tax advantaged accounts, whether that's a 401k at work or an IRA or a Roth IRA are all good choices. Some workers now have access to health savings accounts, depending on the type of health insurance they have at work. And those can be good places to save money too. They're triple tax exempt. So, you know, sock away as much as you can and, you know, pay some attention to what your expected Social Security benefit will be. And all workers have the ability to get a projection on that from the Social Security Administration. You can sign up for an online account at the SSA.gov website, which can take some doing, but it can be done. And you can download a benefit statement there that'll give you a projection of what your future benefit will look like.
Teresa, anything to add?
Yeah, I would just say what a remarkable daughter. She sounds wonderful. She should really also pay attention to her career and to maintaining her work life, her work skills, connections with employers, so that she doesn't miss another couple of years. We may be coming into a recession, and older workers actually find a little bit harder time to actually keep their jobs and keep their hours in a recession. So she should be very attentive to her work life and stay in the labor market about as long as she can.
Yeah.
Yes, I meant to add that, too. Working longer would be a really good prescription here.
Let's go to Richard in Savage. Richard?
Yes, I've got a question about if you can, you know, start claiming your Social Security, and then if you get a great job offer, being able to quit Social Security and postpone it for another year or two and then claim it again later. Is
so
that possible?
I'm hoping that you've gotten a great job offer.
I think I might.
Okay. Teresa?
Well, that's great. Have you already started to collect your Social Security?
No, I haven't, but I'm thinking about doing it within a month or two.
Yeah, don't. Once you start taking your Social Security, you can't suspend it and then accrue a what's called a delayed retirement credit. So I'm really glad to hear that. How old are you? Did you tell us that?
No, I am 63.
Then it's best to delay as much as you can. And while you're waiting for that great job offer, actually live off of other savings if you can. But whatever you do, delay claiming as much as you can, because you can't reverse the decision.
All right. Now let's go to Carolyn in Jordan. Carolyn?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my question. And I think the previous caller kind of alluded to the same question, and I had. 2 years ago, I retired after 39 years as a registered nurse and rotating all three shifts, and I took my Social Security, and I also have a pension. However, at the time when I took my COBRA medical insurance, it was a little over $600 a month, and I had stockpiled some money and some PTO and EST to be used towards that premiums. However, the net this year, it went up to $844 a month. And now they told me that the first of the year, it's going up to $1,044 a month. And I'm tempted to go back to work. I'll be 64 in January. And so I have 1 year till I get to Medicare age, but I hate to, I find it's really going to be difficult for us to maintain our standard of living when I'm paying over $1,000 a month medical insurance. What would happen to my Social Security if I do go back to work?
Mark, Teresa?
Well, going back to work is only...
Go ahead, Mark.
Teresa.
No, go ahead, Mark.
Okay. Go ahead. Okay.
Going back to work is only going to be positive for your Social Security benefit because it, you know, contributes more earnings, more years of earning history, probably at your highest salary. I was going to ask about the COBRA. Have you compared the cost of COBRA to buying a policy on the Affordable Care Act exchanges?
My understanding is I would not qualify financially for that. So, and if I did, and so the premiums would be higher for me than what I'm paying now.
Oh, I see. You don't qualify for the subsidized policy on the ACA exchange, I think it sounds like. So then that'd be higher than COBRA. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm stuck between a rock and a hard place.
I would have recommended shopping around for a cheaper plan. But the good news is you only have to do it for a year.
Right.
So maybe going back to work, if you can just work a couple of shifts to maintain your living standard, that might be a very good opportunity for you.
Yeah.
And what a wonderful career. That's very impressive.
So I want to make a...
Chris, could I toss one thing that's kind of not exactly this question, but it brings up an important subject, which is this transition of health insurance at the point of retirement. There's a lot of misunderstanding about this and ability to get yourself in trouble vis-a-vis penalties on Medicare. This caller did not say this, but a lot of folks who are on COBRA mistakenly think they can stick with COBRA at age 65 rather than switch to Medicare. I don't know why people would want to do that, but some apparently do. And you can't do that. Likewise, if you're on the Obamacare exchanges or receiving coverage through the ACA via Medicaid, at 65, you still need to move to Medicare because if you don't sign up for Medicare on time, penalties, late enrollment penalties begin to kick in. Now, if you're still employed full time and have employer coverage, in most cases, you can stick with the employer coverage and delay Medicare enrollment. But this is one of those things that I think it's one of the trickiest topics out there related to the transition from work to retirement, and something that people need to pay close attention to.
Yeah, well, my brother got caught in this because he thought COBRA, which he was under, was an employer plan, so therefore he didn't need to file for Social Security. And it's a it's an understandable mistake to make. And it's surprising, and I guess it's not surprising, but a lot of people do make it, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and you know, these health savings accounts that I was mentioning earlier, that's another twist on this whole thing, because you can only contribute to a health savings account if you're enrolled in a high deductible insurance plan. And so when you approach that transition, let's say you work full time and you have a high deductible workplace plan plus an HSA. At the point that you transition to Medicare, you can no longer contribute to the HSA because Medicare is not a high deductible insurance plan. And so people can get caught up in these rules. You have to stop contributing to the HSA 6 months before enrollment in Medicare, and it goes on and on. So, you know, it's just another area that's become, I believe, needlessly complicated, but there we have it.
Okay, we're getting toward the end, but I do want to address head-on one of these issues. We've touched on it, but David, who is in St. Paul, he's left a message, and he said, why don't we raise the cap on individuals who make more money to make up the shortfall? And we've mentioned the cap, so Teresa, define the cap, and then what would be the effect of raising the cap?
Everybody pays 6.4% for their Social Security, and so do your employer, up into the earnings cap, which changes every year. And next year, please help me out, it's $135,900, about that. So next year, it's $135,000. So Jeff Bezos and you for listeners, changes the system as if you make $135,000. $1,900 per year or less. If we charged people who make much more than that, and 1% of Americans earn over $253,000, so there's a lot of money that is not taxed above that cap. If we taxed everybody for all the income that they earn, it would add a substantial amount of income to the Social Security system. It wouldn't solve the entire shortfall, but it would go almost to 80% of the shortfall. The politics
Go ahead, Teresa.
No, sorry, go ahead. Go ahead, please.
The politics are is that high-income workers would face a tax increase. So all of a sudden, you know, they will have to pay a lot more money on their benefits. But we haven't tested whether or not that would be really politically acceptable. Mark actually knows this literature more than I do, but people at all income levels support the system, realize that they put money in, they get it back, and it actually may be a very popular and easy fix.
Mark?
Yeah, so another way of looking at this is like the share of the total wage base that's subject to the payroll tax, and it's declined in the last couple of years.
And the payroll
tax,
that's what pays into Social Security.
Yeah. So it's gone from roughly 90% of the wage base being taxed to roughly 80%. So we've not kept up, in essence. A lot of that has to do with income inequality and galloping ahead at the top. I think that the Larson bill would definitely increase the cap on wages subject to taxes, the bill I was discussing earlier. The interesting thing is, if you just eliminate the cap entirely, I think the political problem that comes up there is that at the very highest end, the taxes go way up, but nothing happens to increase the benefit. And so, you know, I think that the whole thing with Social Security is that all-in earned benefit. We're all in it together. We put in the same, get roughly the same out. And I think that's its political strength. So while I think an increase in the wage base would be great, I think we have to balance it carefully.
So I'd like to thank both of you for taking your time. This has been a wonderful conversation. I have a much longer list of questions to that I would like to have gotten to, but I'm so glad the callers reached out with their questions. So Mark Miller is a journalist and author. Teresa Ghilarducci is a professor of economics at the New School for Social Research. So thank you to both of you for taking your time in this holiday season to join us talk about Social Security.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!